Not get an image.
Yeah.
Like, I got a very strong image of children in a prison right in the basement.
Mm.
And I got as far as contacting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it happens, but it's really fleeting.
Yeah.
And then the experience fades out.
Yeah.
So, to go on and on and on is almost torture.
Nah. Wrapping in hell, get out of there.
Yeah.
Leave the basement. Really. No, sorry, we could spend a lot of time talking about how to do this skillfully, and I just want to offer it briefly. It's both landing a fish and learning how to fish related to this taking the good, and the fourth step, the fish being wholesome narcissistic supplies.
Yeah.
So in that light, I'll be quite brief, but I appreciate you bringing that out. First, isn't it a demonstration of the negativity bias? You could hang out all day in jail, you know, but sustaining a positive experience based on real facts, of people who care about you, or real accomplishments, or factually based wholesome qualities, really hard for the mind to stay there. And then that's just a teaching. Well, okay, you need to, it's a concentration practice.
Yeah.
It's like people, you know, count the breaths, you know, 1 to 10, and their threshold is 1, 2, gone. Right? Okay, now we're working on 3. I mean, I've noticed a lot the threshold is around the 4th breath, I think, because concentration naturally fatigues because we deplete metabolic supplies, you know, support concentration in the beginning. Then we get past the 4th breath to the 5th, the 6th, and so forth. So that second step would be for you a growing edge to focus on, and strictly focus on the positive, including the positive being the target of the antidotes that you know are your vitamin C without accessing that old place of things. And then the larger frame too of knowing where we are, honestly. Knowing our strengths, knowing our vulnerabilities, and then being our own friend. You know, as you said earlier, being like a good friend to ourselves. There's a phrase you may have heard of, Kalyanamitta, spiritual friend. You may have Kalyanamitta groups here, people gather around, maybe common interests, and typically are leaderless. To be a Kalyanamitta for oneself. I don't know, it gives me a shiver right now. I've never said that. That's very sweet to be a spiritual friend. Maybe one more person? Yep, right here.
Well, this relates a bit to what I said before when you showed me that probably one of the three was much more difficult.
Uh-huh.
And it was the one where there's more of an issue.
Yeah.
The others, there wasn't such an issue.
Right. Yeah.
And that was where you have to work quite hard to not dwell in it.
Yeah, I did. I don't think it's an exhaustive list, just to recategorize it. Because again, you can look for this as your vitamin C. You know, experiences of feeling cared about. Experiences of recognition of accomplishment, of respect or praising, either delivered from the outside or knowing that you've accomplished something. And then third, a recognition of a positive quality in oneself. There are other ways into healthy narcissistic supplies. But that's a good, those are, I think, 3 good ways in. All right. So hopefully on the basis of that, okay, we can talk about doing and being. But before I do that, because if I don't do it now, I'll probably forget again, I've been asked a few times already to comment on the difference between the 2 CD programs I've done there, the orange one and the blue one, you know, Meditations to Change Your Brain, or Stress-Proof Your Brain. The truth is they overlap to some extent in their view and information. There's a little bit of repetition of information between the first and the second. I don't think there's any real repetition of practice, although I may have reviewed quickly taking the good in the second CD, the blue CD, which I did later. That said, the difference is the first one is quite foundational. It addresses things like ways to steady the mind, and so forth. The second one is more about stress proofing, more about dealing with emotional upset, stress, you know, the activation of the sympathetic nervous system, and so forth. And it's more recent, so there's more things in it that are not also in my book. Both have been appreciated. I've honestly been kind of blown away by the degree to which they were appreciated. Especially, you know, the second one just came out. So I like them. I hope they are valuable for you. That's the difference. And if you don't want to get them, I've got a lot of talks. Some practices, mostly talks, recorded, freely offered on my website, buddhistbrain.com. Okay? Okay. Great. Do what you mean. I really like this material. I'm about to go into it, so you know that. I'm enthusiastic about it. So I'll do this kind of briskly because I want to end by 5. And also because it lends itself in a way to moving through it kind of briskly. Otherwise, it's easy to get lost in. And first of all, take a look at this list of characteristics that are paired. All right. So, for example, maybe it's. I love it. I've never done this before. Point with one of these things. Okay. Goal directed, compared with nothing to do, nowhere to go. Right. Or abstract or concrete. Or future past compared to now. You can see that these are two kind of different ways of being that often they cluster together. Right? Now, if we look at them, we can see that modern life and modern schooling basically is a deep training in the first column. The quote-unquote doing column. And I use that word in quotes very kind of loosely. But this is really the doing column. This is what we do when we're working. I'm doing this column a lot right now. You're probably doing it a fair amount too. Okay? On the other hand, when we engage contemplative practice, or often when we want to open into a different way of being, or we're hanging out with friends, or we're being with a loved one, or we're tuning into nature, or we're engaging art, making, let's say, some kind of creative process, we want to be able to move more into the second mode. All right? Quite distinct. Different ways of being. Yes, you can move back and forth. Yes, I'm being a little dualistic here. Yes, in certain occasions, they're very integrated. But I think we could appreciate, I don't know about you, but it feels really different for me if I'm in column A or column B. If I'm in doing mode or being mode. It feels really different. Okay? Now, in terms of the brain, what's interesting is that the doing column, the left column, which is typically studied in terms of self-referencing, which is very much why I'm bringing it up today, yet has many components in it that are not specifically related to selfing. For example, the way in which it typically is saturated with verbal material, or that it has a very judgmental evaluative nature. It correlates to selfing in that it's very goal-directed, it's very survival-focused. We typically engage the first column when we're in the, what I called yesterday, the reactive mode of the brain, when we're trying to solve problems, when we're trying to go get carrots or avoid sticks or clutch to us, we're in the first column, which does activate self, as we've seen already. Right? Interestingly, when people are in the first territory, that first column, they activate networks in the midline of the brain, the middle of the brain, front to back. And that's what you see in this slide. Dorsal means upper, all right, like the dorsal spine of or fin of a whale. MPFC stands for medial prefrontal cortex. Okay, the most important letter up there is M in medial. It's the medial. It's the upper middle of the cortex, more in the front. All right, that's what's activated when we're doing that first column. When we're planning for the future, when we're ruminating about the past, when we're commenting to ourselves about ourselves, all right, or even taking a step further, commenting to ourselves about ourselves, whatever, going meta on meta and all the way up, whatever it is, we're there. The X's, by the way, if you see that, that's where the slide is. These are slices of the brain looking this way, okay, and the X is millimeters, so it's either, 11 millimeters, which is just over a centimeter, of course, in one direction from the midline, or 3 centimeters in one direction from the midline, or 7 millimeters in the other direction. The point is, it's just millimeters. It's very, very close to the midline. That's where parts of the brain really light up when we're doing this first column. Yeah? Let's see, so I don't know which, it's in the middle, basically. So I actually don't know in what direction, left or right, the minus means. Maybe some neuroscientist. Okay, great, yeah. So this is more a little bit more left-sided, a little more right-sided, but the point is that it's in the midline. Thanks. Okay? Yeah, it's right there in the middle. Okay? So moving along, in a different slide, they did an experiment that's very related to real life. Where basically they said in two conditions, okay, condition one, we're going to show you some adjectives like, that are kind of trait adjectives like friendly, shy, anxious, irritable, ambitious, pleasant, dutiful, whatever. And we want you to think about the ways in which that applies to you, especially does it fit you? Are you like that? Have you been like that? What are you doing about that? What do you think about being that way? Is that good or is it bad? Do that, all right? And then in the second condition, instead of doing that, we're going to show you the same words on a screen in the MRI, but in this case, we just want you to be present with whatever arises related to that. We want you to do open, mindful awareness, essentially, related to whatever arises in the mind around the reactions. Just kind of be with the reactions that arise to these words, right? So that was the red condition. So blue is what happens in the brain when people are thinking and planning and kind of self-referencing related to those words, and red is when they're doing mindfulness. As you can see, when they were doing blue, when they were doing the first column of doing, self-referential thinking, you know, kind of directed thinking, they were lighting up midline systems, particularly on the right-hand side, you see that. Okay, right in the middle there, see midline networks. But when they did the open spacious awareness, they lit up more lateralized networks, okay, especially on the right-hand side of the brain. And they were able to sustain that open spacious mindfulness for about 10 seconds. And after that, very quickly, those midline networks took control again. Doing hijacked being, which we've probably noticed again and again and again on the cushion, as it were, or whatever we meditate on. In my case, a chair for my aging back. All right? You see that? In other words, doing, which we're deeply trained in. Because we're trained in it, we stimulate those substrates, we strengthen those substrates. Modern schooling is a deep training or building of a muscle of doing. Most careers in the modern world, in the Western world certainly, Western industrial world, are in the doing mode. Therefore, we tend to develop it, and it really has a lot of power. It's like building up a huge bicep, right? With kind of a wimpy little tricep, being mode, right? And we start doing bicep-related activities, which build the bicep further in a circular way, right? So the untrained mind, or untrained brain as well, can light up those lateralized networks for a little while. But then they get hijacked by doing mode again. To take it one step further, though, with training, people can indeed stabilize the lateralized networks. They can stabilize that open, spacious awareness and can stabilize being mode. So with training, you can see that people were much more able to sustain the red blotches, where you really see the point is on this right side of the column, where they were able to sustain activation on the side of the brain, mainly the right side of the brain, which kind of makes sense, because if you're engaged in a kind of an open, spacious awareness, an awareness that has a lot of panoramic quality to it, you know, edgelessness to it, you're much more likely to use the right hemisphere, which does gestalt awareness. I think the right hemisphere is very involved in ekagata, in unification, because of what it does with gestalt awareness. And it also is very involved in the visualization, if you will, of the panoramic space.
What was the training?
What they did in that study? They did 8 weeks of MBSR, or a variation.
Okay.
It is a basic mindfulness training. You know, in the real world, 20 minutes a day, most subjects cheat, you know, somewhat, but still, they got this benefit. They were able to activate those lateralized networks and stabilize the activation, which corresponds to our experience in training. As we train the mind, we become increasingly able to stabilize open, spacious awareness rather than getting back into, you know, wandering thought.
If someone is on the left, all the right brain.
That, you mean in terms of the red? Yeah, you're right. There is some prefrontal cortex, but it's lateralized, you know, more. Okay.
If the neuroscientist asked them how they felt.
What's that?
This is left arm, MRI. Did they ask them how they felt?
You can read the study. It's actually, I think I posted it on my site because I think it's a PNAS. I think this is available in the public domain. Maybe not, but I don't remember that part, what they felt, but they presumably were doing what they were supposed to do. You know, yeah. The larger point, interestingly, is we can actually do things that cultivate the being mode. And the being mode, it's not that it's better or worse than the doing mode. There's a place for both of them. But let's face facts. Hello? Modern civilization is totally tilted toward the doing mode. Some of us, particularly the more artistic and sensitive among us, are casualties of schooling and vocationalizing in the doing mode. And our real nature is much more suited to being mode. Because there's, again, neurological diversity there. And being mode is much more supportive of relaxing the sense of I. Right? There's much less sense of I in the being mode. Yeah.
Are you talking about left brain and right brain here? Because I can't go home without when people ask you if you're familiar with the book of Shorter Insight.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. So kind of quickly on that. So there is what's called hemispheric specialization, you know, and for most people, particularly right-handed people, including some left-handed people, the left hemisphere is specialized for sequential processing, the right hemisphere for gestalt, holistic processing, which lends itself naturally to the left hemisphere being specialized for language, because language is sequential, where nouns and verbs, adjectives, and so forth have to be in the right order for a sentence to make sense. And the right hemisphere is specialized for visual spatial functioning, because that's gestalt, that's whole. Okay, that's the basic thing. It can, in this particular case, the real distinction in terms of this dichotomy I'm doing here is between medial, midline, and side. Middle versus side, especially the right, but it's really between middle and side. That's the key distinction. Lately, there's been, I think, you know, in the culture of these fads, the swing back and forth, there's been a kind of almost idolization of the right hemisphere. And the truth is that the left hemisphere is very involved in positive emotion. There's actually a specialization toward positivity on the left side in a variety of ways, including the fact that the left prefrontal cortex is very involved in inhibiting negative affect. So if you get greater asymmetry of activation in the left prefrontal cortex compared to the right prefrontal cortex, you have more happiness. And there's a direct correlation between years of meditative practice, or even months in a mindfulness study, and the increased activation of the left prefrontal cortex. Okay? Right? It's not just. In other words, the right hemisphere actually seems specialized a little for negative affect. In part because... And also, it's interesting that the right hemisphere is specialized, gets a bit of an advantage, or kind of gets a head start in development in the first 18 months of life. And it kind of makes sense because our ancient ancestors and even modern human infants needed fairly quickly to be tracking this around, because that's where threats come from, generally. Right? So it would make sense you'd want the right hemisphere to be kind of turbocharged. Right? Then the left hemisphere comes online, starts catching up around the 18-month mark, second birthday for sure, which is coincident with what? The advent of language. So, Jill Bolte Taylor, in My Stroke of Insight, if you want to see her talk at TED, you can just Google Jill Bolte Taylor or My Stroke of Insight. It's a riveting talk. I recommend it. And to me, she has a super good heart, but in many ways, her book and her teaching, I think, misrepresents the neurology, which is curious because she herself is a neuroscientist. And basically, she had a devastating and catastrophic stroke back here. So what happened when she had that stroke back here? She blew out her speech centers. And second, she blew out a part of the parietal cortex that essentially separates self from world. So, and there's because there's this thing called reciprocal inhibition, the two hemispheres inhibit each other. Because she suddenly suppressed a lot of left hemisphere function, ka-whoosh, this right hemisphere global awareness, spatial openness just boom, really took over. Kind of see what I mean? It'd be like being near at a stoplight, one foot on the brakes, one foot on the gas. You suddenly pop your foot off the brakes and whoo! Okay, so suddenly she was, wow, taken out into like complete non-dual bliss awareness with no words. Right? And she liked it. Right? And you know, then she had to rehabilitate the capacity to come back. That's cool. But she didn't take out her left prefrontal cortex. If she had, she might have been freaking terrified of the experience. She had good inhibition of negative affect. You know? And also, second, what are the implications? What are we going to do? Go on retreat if someone hit us in the head on the left parietal region, left temporal junction right here? Temporal parietal, kaboom? You know, get a root? No, we can't. Like, what are the implications from that? I mean, I think the implications are we need both. And the other thing is, I think to myself, you know, all kinds of people, many, if not all of you in this room right here, have had similar kinds of openings or experiences achieved in more of a gradual and earned way under your own control.
The kind of temptation reading this book, to be quite honest, where I felt like all I got to do is to nurture my right side.
Right.
At the expense of the left.
I think it's about integration. I mean, the Buddha, you know, he used a lot of words. He was good at words. But he was also good at the jhanas, right? He just dropped there. And it's about integration. As I said yesterday, I think, to a question about, you know, what's the place of love and mating, if you will, in practice. And I think enlightenment appropriately is grounded in the whole body. And I respect people who are monastics. I really respect them. I bow to them. I think of them as like Prometheus, you know, bringing fire from the gods down to the rest of us because of their sincerity and dedication. But, you know, we have two hemispheres, not one. As my friend and teacher James Barra said about the three jewels in Buddhism, you know, the teacher, the teaching, and the community we taught, you know, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. We were developing community at Spirit Rock Meditation Center where I was on the board for a while. You know, James said in one of our meetings, you know, the Buddha said there are three jewels, not two, right? Which includes community, the third jewel, which often gets left out in Dharma circles in the West, even though it's deeply embedded in the East. Same way, we have two hemispheres, not one. You know, we have a front and a back, a top and a bottom, all moving together, you know, on the path of awakening. Okay. So.
Could you just say the name again?
Jill Bolte Taylor. Taylor. In the interest of time, I'm being a little truncated in my, you know, response. I don't want to be snarky about it. She's very sincere, full of heart, very bright, has a wonderful thing to say, and her story is unbelievably compelling. You watch this TED video and you just go, wow. Part of it is there's a little oddity still in her mannerisms that makes it also a little compelling. Okay.
Can I tell just a quick anecdote about this left-right business?
Yeah.
The work I do, I direct the learning journey. And my own brain is too active on right prefrontal. And when the service is pressuring me, it's a slight issue as well. And I've been meditating practice for 6 months from the week. And I re-measured them recently, because I had an experience of them being back in balance. But I didn't want to see it, you know, like
wow.
When you were looking at the scales.
Yeah. And, for sure, I do that too.
And they're back in balance. Mm-hmm. After 6 months.
Isn't that amazing? And what a demonstration. Use your mind to change your brain. Wonderful. If you heard her, she said there was initially a kind of asymmetry, more, you know, advantage to the right, which is associated with more negative affect. She then did practices which gradually felt from the inside that there was more evenness, more positive emotion, less, you know, negative hijacking, if you will. And she was curious, gee, has my brain changed too? They did some kind of measure scan, maybe EEG, I don't know, neurofeedback. Yeah, those things, yeah. And she found that, in fact, there was now more left frontal activation. Right here. Thank you. You demonstrated. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so doing and being. Now, both are really important, okay? There are some very interesting, for me at least, implications of the right-hand column. Because the right-hand column, particularly when we're deeply engaged in it, sounds a lot like the Bahia Sutta, which is where we began today. You may know this story in the Dharma, in which Bahia, who was a teacher and a pretty mature practitioner at the time, sought out the Buddha's teachings. So he traveled a long distance on foot to find the Buddha. This is how he traveled then, on foot, of course. Found him and asked for his teachings. The Buddha initially said, not now, Bahia, not now. And Bahia said, "No, please, noble sir, give me your teachings." And Buddha, dramatically, that's how it's told, said, "Not now, Bahia." And the Bahia persisted a third time, "Please, noble sir, give me your teachings." And because supposedly, traditionally, if you ask three times, it's hard to say no to the third request. Okay? And so the Buddha said, and then to me at least, I just imagine a combination of the Buddha, you know, a real figure, a real human, a real man, recognizing that he is a deep practitioner, teacher of some standing himself, and a certain impatience, or I don't know what, kind of like, "Are you really? Okay, I'm going to give it to you right now." You know, a little bit of that. I'll tell you this. Do you know the Rahula Sutta? Do you know that? This is the Buddha talking to Rahula. Rahula is his son. He left his kid, and finally, after his own awakening, came back, you know, reconciled with his family, etc. So Rahula becomes one of his students, a little junior monk, right? And there's this really neat sutta, the Rahula Sutta, where Rahula's doing something. I don't know what, you know. It's not quite clear what he's doing, but it's not right. And so the Buddha, his dad, can you imagine your dad, the Buddha, laying it on you? Now Rahula, and it's really great. Basically, he says, look, fundamentally, it's wise effort in a nutshell. He says, before you do something, while you're doing something, and after doing something, ask yourself, was this wholesome or not? Basically. If it is wholesome, great. Keep on, keep on. If it's not wholesome, stop. Don't do it. Rahula. Are you listening to me, Rahula? You know, like, woo. Anyway, so I imagine the Buddha in a real way saying, okay, so this is the teaching right here. What a pith teaching. You know, okay, Bahia, here's the teaching. You should practice this. You should train yourself. In the seen, let there be only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the sensed or known or cognized, thought, in other words, only the thought. Then, when for you, and this is a summary of the Bahia Sutta, it's kind of pith. When that's the case, right, there's no you in there. Right? There is seeing, there is hearing, there is touching, there are executive functions, there is selecting. There is adjusting or moving to what someone wants by, right? There is that. But there need not be Bahia there. There need not be you there or Rick there. And when there's no you in that, there's no you there. In other words, you in that is a momentary construction of self. And when there's not that momentary construction of self, or addition, self is added. Self is added to seeing, or hearing, or thinking, or sensing, or planning. One can plan, one can have executive functions, one can choose, one can use language, one can understand. Self is added to comprehending. Okay? When self is not added, there's no self there. There's no you there. And when there's no you there, there's no you anywhere. There's no you there, or yonder in some mystical plane, or between the two. There's just no you there, in that moment, right there, direct. And when there's no you there, that, just this, is the end of suffering. Supposedly, you know, some high drama, that drama continues, but he is enlightened on the spot. Literally, whoa, just, you know, it's ba-bam, right between the eyes, boom, enlightened on the spot, okay? Then to add to the drama, you may know where the sutta ends, Bahia and this Buddha part, and shortly thereafter, Bahia is gored by an ox and dies. I don't know why they put that in. It seems like, to me, that adds to the credibility story. Like, why in the world would you drop that in? You know, right? And then later, you know, the Buddha heard it, oh, too bad. And, well, at least he was enlightened before he died. Okay. So, anyway, that's the Bahia sutta. Very high drama sutta. But the essence of it is right here, right? In the seen, let there be only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. That's how you should train. Right? Do you see the relationship between this and the second column there, the being column? I think that the intermediate expression of lateral network activation in the being column is very helpful for just simply being present with loved ones, or doing your own practice, being on the cushion. But at the upper limit, a deep capacity to sustain lateral network activation is at the heart of, you know, in the seen there is only the seen, and the heard only the heard. No you there at all. So then the question is, given the implications that are very profound, very, very profound, of the complete activation of the being mode and a recognition in the being mode, it's as if in the being mode we see the doing mode arise, in a sense, and we recognize it as just one more content in awareness, including its representations of a seeming self. How do we do it? How do we activate being mode? So I want to just mention a few, do a little practice, and wrap up today. Okay? There are a number of ways, and some neurologically clever ways, to activate lateral networks are to sense the body as a whole. I talked about earlier as a way into the fifth jhana factor, unification of awareness, to sense the body as a whole, because that has to take you out in the lateral network activation. You're being in the whole, you're being with the whole, okay? Right there. Another one is don't know mind. When we are surprised, when we're a joke, when people get a joke, they light up lateral networks because it's startling. It's a joke. It's surprising. Or we're surprised otherwise. So don't know mind. In other words, not needing mental contents to make any sense. And also not needing them to stick together. Sophie Rinpoche had a nice statement about that. He said, the problem is not that you have thoughts. The problem is that you try to stick them together. You try to make them make sense or link. It's very interesting practice to kind of open up and relax and say, it doesn't have to make any sense at all. To let it go and not need it makes sense. A couple others that I'll do a quick question. Another one is panoramic awareness, bird's eye view, the 1,000-foot view, the 30,000-foot airplane view, you know, kind of being with your experience, this great sense of space, any sense of boundless, you know, edgeless awareness tends to take us out to that boundless place that lateralized network activation supports. Yeah?
I just want to quickly refer to some Rinpoche quote, because his father used to say that the average life of thought is 3 seconds. Everything else is an exaggeration.
Oh, right, right. That's exactly right, actually, because truly, neurologically, I mean, the neurological truth that maps to that subjective experience, the thoughts typically don't last more than a few seconds, is it's, you can't sustain a neural coalition very long in the global workspace of awareness. It disperses very quickly. It may be regenerated again and again with a new coalition, if you will, representing the same thought, but there is an inherent instability, which one can appreciate. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the flow. Is flow somehow, could you put it?
Yeah.
Or is it like something completely different?
No, where does flow fit? That's a great question, I think. And I suspect that flow is a wonderful higher order integration of the two. Because, and I think people who are very, very awakened and developed actually have a very subtle movement back and forth between these two columns. In the beginning, you know, there's an old saying that first you differentiate to integrate. You have to differentiate to integrate. Or in relational language, fences make for good neighbors. Right? In other words, individuation is the basis of intimacy. Same here. I think since particularly most of us at least are deeply trained in this column, practice stabilizing this one. You know, just like the people in that study, practice stabilizing those lateral networks. And then move on. First do differentiation, right? Sense the distinctions between the two. Explore this world. And then come back and do more of an integration. Now, as to flow, I am not aware of any neurological studies of what's happening in flow because it's a very transient phenomenon. You know, how are you going to do it? There you are, you know, some soccer player. I watched this guy kick a goal, you know, in a very dexterous way on British TV. I'm actually becoming fond of football, you call it, I think. You know, like I used to think soccer was football. It's like watching paint dry, you know. But now I'm really starting to appreciate the nuances. It's cool. And flat screen TVs help you appreciate the nuances. But anyway, big TVs. Anyway, and so what do? Stop someone in the moment? Or an artist in the moment of inspiration, or someone solving a problem. Hold on now, you get an MRI here. Right? Hard to do. So when you just take the psychological account of flow and then try to operationalize it neurologically, which is what a lot of you try to do, there I think you're talking about, there's a lot of being there. There's little sense of I. It's very in the now. It's very immediate. But on the other hand, there seems to be a gentle, subtle directiveness. It's aimed. It's productive.
Right.
Yeah, often you are doing something. So there's a minimal. I think it's a very interesting state. Right? You know, my thought might be what you would see is strong activation of both networks simultaneously. That's a guess, but a decent one off a good question. Okay. I want to do a couple more just kind of slides, draw your attention to them, and then we'll finish with a practice. So in terms of activating being mode, I've talked about how to do whole body awareness already. I do offer that to you as a very useful method, whole body awareness. I think it's helpful to start doing it at home, you know, in a fairly focused setting. But I've played around with it in settings that are potentially quite stressful, and it's a wonderful way to just step out of the whole stressful deal. And to relax the sense of self, to have more a sense that someone talked about who's somewhere you are, right there. When there's less sense of I, you as well, there's less sense of afferent or incoming input, just things are happening when you go into this whole body awareness. So I do it, for example, like with the in-laws sometimes. They're all just doing their thing, you know. I'm trying to feel my skin, all skin at once. If nothing else is distracting. I'm doing what our daughter Laurel's best friend used to tell her to do in fourth grade. Laurel, find your happy place. You know, I'm going to my happy place. Skin all together. Okay, whole body awareness. A second one here. Oh, as awareness, there's this panoramic awareness. Okay? That's where we have a sense, particularly for more visual, or you don't have to be visual to do it. You can do it with sound, a sense of spaciousness, or even sensation. If you close your eyes, especially if you close your eyes, you know, and you start playing around body sensation, you realize that the localization of the sensation is added to it. It's like a little yellow sticky that says left foot or right foot, but the experiencing of it, it's kind of just there. You know, it's more panoramic, we know, more spacious enough. Or if you're more visual, you can imagine looking at your experience from a distance, you know, like through the wrong end of a telescope. If someone knows about NLP, it's an NLP technique, neuro-linguistic programming technique. You know. And in that, you have a sense of contents of awareness, you know, passing by, like clouds or flocks of birds coming and going, you know, never tainting awareness itself. As Ajahn Sumedho says here, you know, contents are transient. They're a completely unreliable basis for happiness. But as long as we live, certainly, awareness is ongoing. And that's where we can take refuge. Okay. So how about we wrap up with about a 5-minute practice. Okay? And actually, and on. Before I do that, I do want to mention a caution, which I could have mentioned earlier. Practices, you remember I said in the beginning, you have to have an ego in order to transcend the ego? You know, that's a quote, I think, from Jack Engel, who's a psychoanalyst and a Buddhist practitioner, writing in the 80s, actually, back then. I think in the 80s. Anyway, for people who have real issues with dissociation, you just really super space out or lose a sense of self or boundary, you know, between person and world, let's say, or borderline personality, very typically enmeshed or fuzzy boundaries and so forth. You know, practices related to relaxing the sense of self are probably counterindicated. And if it starts, if you do these kind of practices and they get, I think what's appropriate, and I speak from my own experience of doing them, as well as building on what some people have said as well, is that when you do them, when you explore relaxing the sense of self, you know, follow the bliss, right? Who was it who said that? I'm blanking on his name. The guy who did A Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell, there we go. Follow your bliss, you know. Follow the pleasure, the ease in less sense of self. You know, start recognizing that selfing feels contracted, tense, anxious, you know, beleaguered, separated from the world. There's a fundamental, I think, fragility, you know, it's constructiveness, like a house of cards. Self is a house of cards, just ready at any moment to be blown away by life. So as we identify with self, we feel that fragility and vulnerability, which can make us kind of anxious. It's unpleasant. Alternately, as there is a growing sense of not-self, or selflessness, or minimal sense of self, notice the kind of the peace in it, and the confidence in it, and appreciate increasingly that you really can move through life as a person, not a self. You know, I actually had a very powerful realization that came after I began developing this material, which I understood, but in the realization, I had a very direct experience that it's really formed a conviction that has stayed with me. Conviction, as you may know, is one of the seven factors of awakening. Right? Conviction or faith. Conviction. You know, belief based on fact. Anyway, a conviction that so much is happening in the brain, in biology, in the mind, here and in relationship with all the influences out there, there can't possibly be a little self owning and controlling and directing all of it. There just can't possibly. There's personhood, you know, which is this, right? The swell of the sea, right, that's the person. There is personhood, right? And as you center more and more in that sense of personhood, it really is helpful to appreciate more and more the positive feeling of that. It feels okay to do that. It's a relief to do that. You know, it feels safe to do that. You can still engage life. The executive functions can still go on, you know, as a person, not a self. So let's finish with a bit of a practice. How about coming into the body that's here as you can, dropping into a growing sense of personness, maybe accompanied by language like, you know, there is sensation, there is thought, there is relief that this workshop is coming to an end. Being aware of breathing. And exploring the sense of being aware of the breath as a whole. The sensations experienced, the belly, the chest, the throat, the nose, all at once. Breathing as a whole. Experiencing the sensations of the breath, including perhaps the breath as a whole, sometimes experienced for only a second or two, and then coming back again, which is fine. Experiencing all that in as wide and edgeless a space of awareness as possible. Sensations of breathing as a whole without needing to understand them or know what they are, arising and passing away in a great open edgeless space. Abiding is breathing. Maybe having a sense, abiding is breathing, is abiding as your own self upon the sea, rising and falling with each breath. But with other swells nearby, other persons, oxygen coming into you, air coming into you, and leaving you. The swell that you are, partaking of so much else in the ocean, of the world, other people, nature, physical reality. Exploring a growing sense of no problem. Abiding as a swell. Abiding as the ocean swelling through you. Perhaps feeling something of the generosity of the ocean, of life, other beings, culture, of the physical universe, of air and food and love, all of that, feeling the generosity of so many more things in the ocean of reality moving through you. That you can afford to relax. In the awareness of no problem. Nothing needs doing. Spaciously aware. Nowhere to go. No one you need to be. To quote the poet Li Po, in a poem that was handed to me as a kind of generosity, one swell to another, the birds have vanished down the sky. Now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, till only the mountain remains. Or as I might add, till only the ocean remains. lovely quote by Thomas Merton up here from another tradition. And I want to say thank you myself very much. I feel truly, really, really heartfelt, truly carried by your own ocean to me. So thank you. We're done. Okay. I've already gotten some chocolate.
And we will send you the slides for this this whole weekend. Rick, are we going to do that after you get back to the US?
Yeah, it'll be in late November, actually.
Right.
Although I could... Well, no, I can email... That's right, I don't have to input these names, so it could be much sooner. I'll email you a PDF of the slides.
Great.
For both days. Yeah, and you can distribute them very quickly, so
Great.
We do that soon.
So we'll get those out probably within the next fortnight, probably. Gary has kindly recorded today, and so in due course, because it's a lot of work that he does preparing all the recordings for our website. Some of you have mentioned this weekend, how much we appreciate that. So there will hopefully be sound files of this weekend on the website in due time. Thank you for that. In 2 weeks' time, we have one of...
May I add something really?
Yeah.
I think we should really also thank the people who helped put this on.
Yeah.
So I'm going to embarrass you.
Yeah.
So if you've got Gary Senga,
failingly stalwart, generous, discreet, amazing in her support. Thank you so much. In 2 weeks' time, we have a weekend retreat at King Alfred's School in Golders Green, when we'll be taught by one of Rick's teachers and mentors, Christina Feldman, for a weekend. So that's a really great opportunity to sit and learn from one of the great pioneers, really, of insight meditation in the West, who has done a lot of work herself in terms of reflecting on teaching about neuroscience and particularly the integration of insight meditation and the whole mindfulness. She's a real pioneer field. So we really invite you to that. Full details on the website. What I meant to say about the sending it out, if anybody would like not to receive the details, please come and see me and we'll write your name on the map. Is there anything else we should be saying? Yeah? Rick is, I think if he has any energy left, which it sounds like he does, he's up for doing some book signing.
Quite a conversation, too. It's good.
Okay, great.
Right. Questions?
Thank you so much for coming. We look forward to seeing you at future events. All the very best.
Thank you.